Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. This week, the president's son, Hunter Biden, has been on trial for three felony gun charges in Delaware court. This happened after a proposed deal with federal prosecutors unraveled. With us to break down the legalities of these charges, defenses, and to talk about the constitutionality of the underlying laws is really, truly one of the most prominent and qualified gun experts in the nation, Dr. Stephen Halbrook. Dr. Halbrook is a lawyer. He's a PhD in philosophy. He's a senior fellow at the Independent Institute. He's the author and lawyer for litigation involving firearms. He's written extensively. He's argued before the Supreme Court. He wrote the book, That Every Man Be Armed, and a newer book, The Right to Bear Arms, A Constitutional Right of the People or a Privilege of the Ruling Class. Dr. Halbrook, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, glad to be on the show, Karen. Thank you for having me.
So I want to talk about these laws. Can you break down the laws that Hunter Biden is accused of violating?
Well, it's a three-count indictment. Two of the counts have to do with him making false statements when he purchased the firearm. And the third count is mere receipt and possession of the firearm by a person who's an unlawful user of or addicted to a controlled substance. So what happened when he filled out what's called the 4473 form? When it's an ATF form when you buy a gun and you check boxes saying that you're not a convicted felon or you're not an unlawful user of drugs. And he checked the no box on the drug question. And so that was October the 12th. And this case has more evidence than any drug gun case I've ever seen, in terms of the actual evidence that the prosecution has. I mean, you've got him on tape, his book, Beautiful Things, saying I'm a drug addict. These texts that he preserved. So he buys the gun on October 12th, and then he sends a text on the 13th saying he's waiting for a dealer named Mookie. And on the 14th, he sends another text. This is to Haley Biden. I was sleeping on a car smoking crack. And then it was not until October 23rd that Haley had found the gun and threw it in the trash bin. So he left not just a smoking gun, but just an incredible amount of evidence against himself.
So is this are these types of charges very normal? I mean, I understand you are under an obligation to report, you know, these things, and just by making a false statement that is a crime. But are these things prosecuted? And the reason I ask is I was just doing some research, and a stat that I saw online was there were about 47 million Americans who have battled substance abuse maybe in the last year. That's the stat I found, and maybe give or take a few million. So the question is, with this many people battling some kind of substance abuse, why is it that these things haven't been prosecuted more readily?
Well, first of all, alcohol is not one of the controlled substances under federal law, although under the laws of many states, you cannot buy a gun while intoxicated, and there may be other laws about carrying a gun while intoxicated. But in terms of federal law, just in terms of the statistics, in the year 2019, about 4,400 people were prosecuted for being a felon in possession of a firearm, but only 90 were prosecuted for the gun and drug offense. Being an illegal alien with a gun, there was only 110. Being convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence and having a gun, there were about 140 prosecutions. So I think one reason it's not prosecuted anywhere near as much as the felon in possession is that just because you're a drug user with a gun, you're not very likely to be caught. And felons, particularly violent felons, blue-collar felons, they tend to get in trouble and expose themselves to law enforcement. So I don't agree the argument that's been made that he's being prosecuted just because of who he is. They prosecute other cases where there's a lot less evidence, and for mere marijuana use, as opposed to here we're talking about crack cocaine. But there's a growing tendency to question some of these federal laws. And in 2022, the Supreme Court held down a decision in a case called New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, and the court said as to whether a particular law is valid, you look at, is the conduct within the text of the Second Amendment, of course, the Second Amendment says that people have a right to keep and bear arms. So, yeah, a person who's like a drug user is within that text. That person is within the people. But then the burden shifts to the government to show that at the founding of our country, the Bill of Rights was adopted in 1791. In that period of time, that there's some kind of legal restriction that's either similar to what we have now or even on point. So did they have any laws back then that would punish a person for possession of a gun in circumstances like this? And so there's one case decided by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals applying this law to the specific facts in the case, but it's called U.S. versus Patrick Daniels, and the court said, as applied to this defendant, the federal law on drugs and guns is unconstitutional. But the facts in his case were very different than the Biden case. He was caught with marijuana and a gun in his possession. He was not high at the time, and there was no evidence about the frequency of the use, although he did admit that maybe 2 weeks out of the month he might use some. But the court looked not only at those facts, but also that this law didn't go on the books until 1968. And so it was certainly not the kind of law that existed at the founding.
Put a hold on that. I'm sorry, but I have to take a break. And I want to get back to the idea that we have to go back to 1791 to look and see if there were restrictions. And if there weren't restrictions, then the law is probably going to be unconstitutional, because I find that really interesting. And does that apply to other areas of constitutional law? We're talking to Dr. Stephen Halbrook, and we're talking about Second Amendment rights on the Karen Conti Show. Back in a minute. We're here with Dr. Stephen Halbrook. We're talking about the Second Amendment, and we're talking about the Hunter Biden case. And I just want to break this down as simply as we can, because I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but I do want to understand a little bit more. Dr. Halbrook, you're still there, correct? Just checking. Dr. Halbrook?
Yes.
There you are. Okay.
Yes.
So what you're saying is that what we need to do when it comes to an analysis of whether a Second Amendment law, a law that has to do with firearms, whether it's constitutional, is we have to go back and look to see if there's an analogous law that was in effect somewhere around 1791, which is, when our country was, when these laws were being, when the Constitution Second Amendment was being written and created. So if there's no law that says that you can't have a gun if you're addicted, then the law would be unconstitutional? Is that kind of what we're saying? I don't want to oversimplify, but is that what we're saying?
Not exactly. You can also look for analogs. And what the government has been arguing is that, people who are drug users, and this really doesn't apply to marijuana users so much, but the hard drug users, they're not only unreliable, but in some cases they're dangerous. And back at the founding, there were laws about people who were either mentally incompetent or insane. So this is one type of law the government is trying to argue is an analog. And what the Court of Appeals, though, that invalidated the law is applied to that one individual said was, he wasn't intoxicated at the time. And you can find laws or analogs where at the founding there were restrictions on persons endangering others by having a gun and being intoxicated at the same time and being in public, for example. But that didn't take place in the incident where the court was dealing with that defendant. So arguments are being made both ways, and there's a lot of contradictions among different courts on these issues. There's other courts that have found the law that we're dealing with here unconstitutional as applied to persons who get caught with marijuana, and then there's other courts that have said the opposite. They've upheld these laws. It's going to take the Supreme Court eventually to sort out this this conflict within different courts around the country.
Do you think that given the makeup of the court at this point and some of the things that you've read, and obviously you're an expert on this, do you think that we're going to see, you know, a loosening up of rules about people getting guns, and that that maybe we're not going to have background checks, or maybe, you know, these kinds of questions about whether you're addicted are not going to be asked anymore because they're going to be irrelevant? Do you see that that's the way that it might be going?
Well, not exactly. They're not going to invalidate background checks. They've already okayed background checks, for example. And there's a pending case right now, United States versus Rahimi, involving a person who had a domestic violence restraining order against him and possessed a gun. That's another federal restriction. And chances are pretty good that the court's going to rule that law to be constitutional and uphold that prosecution. And so we also have law and order justices on the court. So we have some that who are pro-Second Amendment, and they'll have to negotiate these different issues that come before them. And so I wouldn't hold my breath looking for any particular one of these federal prohibitions to be invalidated under the Second Amendment, but they're certainly undergoing scrutiny. And so what you might see is some of the laws being considered invalid as applied to specific kinds of people. For example, all felons are prohibited from possessing a gun, but there's violent felonies, and there's some felonies that it's only a felony because somebody made it up. You know, it's a law that's maybe even unheard of in most states. I mean, there's so many federal felonies, it's incredible. So I think a lot of these laws are going to come under scrutiny. We'll see what happens.
So I'm going to go back to the domestic violence one, because this one is of concern to me. I do family law, and I understand domestic violence to some extent. And in this case, the facts are pretty bad. I mean, this guy had a domestic violence restraining order. He threatened a different woman with a gun on five different occasions. He opened fire in public. So this is a factually kind of disturbing case, which, you know, again, when the law gets applied without the emotion and all of that, you're saying that you think the Supreme Court is likely to say it's okay to bar this guy from having a gun. Do you think that's your prediction on how the court's going to rule?
Well, I attended the oral argument, and that would be what I would bet on if I was a betting man.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be a very narrow opinion. And let's also keep in mind that most of the things he did, he's under state charges for those, and those are more serious crimes than mere possession of a gun. I mean, the actual misuse of the gun, you know, firing it at buildings where people were inside and things like that. So he's not the kind of guy you would want to have live next door, and I think the government was
right.
Very pleased with the facts in this case to get that case to the Supreme Court, whereas there might be another case where somebody has a domestic violence restraining order, but the facts might show that the person agreed to it. Both parties could have even agreed to it. So it's a little more complicated than at first glance.
So, you know, and again, going back to this idea that we go back to 1791 and we say, hey, are there any analogous cases or rulings or laws that sort of say that domestic violence perpetrators should be barred from having a gun? Well, I don't even know how you go back that far, because, you know, domestic violence wasn't even a crime back then, to my knowledge. And women didn't really have many rights when it came to in domestic relationships. So I know that I'm not asking you to override the Supreme Court and what they've said, but is it fair to do that? Is it fair to say that we need to have an analogous law in order to have this Constitution be a living, breathing document?
Well, there's a lot of myths about this background. I mean, if you go back to English law, Sir William Blackstone made clear that husbands cannot just beat wives, and assault and battery and murder and all these other normal crimes, they were applicable as well in the domestic context. So, you know, it's not the case that anybody, a man could do anything he wanted to a woman at the founding if they were married. And the laws are better now, and of course we have specific laws that apply to domestic violence, but all the things that are accomplished in the domestic law violence laws now were also accomplished in the general criminal laws that applied universally at the founding.
And just one final one final question, and it's got to be quick because I'm going to make sure I get the names of your books out there for people who are interested. The Supreme Court decides things all the time that don't go back, you know, to 1791. So, for instance, they're making laws about TikTok, or I'm deciding cases based upon social media or things that just didn't exist back in the 1700s. How do you explain that versus having to go back and find something analogous when it comes to Second Amendment?
Well, the court does look at, like, free speech and free press. The Internet's protected because of free speech and press. And if you go back to the fact we only had printing presses at one time, the old-fashioned manual kind, those rights are retained and the modern technology is protected. And so the court actually does the same kind of analysis to the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment and the other ones in terms of what did the founders intend, what abuses were they trying to get at when they adopted the Bill of Rights, and which is for protection from government. And so it's really not an abrogation of what they do in other kinds of constitutional rights. Every constitutional right, they're going to be looking at the text of the right as is expressed in the Bill of Rights, and they're going to be looking at what abuses, like by the British or otherwise, was this intended to guard against? What did the founders seek to do?
Dr. Stephen Halbrook, I'm so sorry, but I want to make sure I plug your book, That Every Man Be Armed, and also The Right to Bear Arms, a Constitutional Right of the People, or a Privilege of the Ruling Class, available on Amazon.